Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:21 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time, and today is February 24th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And this has been a relatively important week. There have been some key developments, not least in the precious metal markets, and I will certainly cover those in a couple of minutes, but I think part of the reason for the relative strength that we're getting in the precious metals right now is because they are beginning to act once more as a safe haven asset, and not least because there has been some doubt thrown on the sustainability of the euro. That of course is not new, but we are starting to see that people are starting to look on these questions with more of a rational mind and beginning at least to understand that we as analysts and as market commentators may look on the market with an analytical mind, but that is in the full understanding that the crowd is highly emotional. That is as true of the market as it is of any crowd. That's something that we talk about at length at the chart seminar. It's quite simple that all crowds are different because they have an animating, their modus operandi is different, and yet they all share similar characteristics. And certainly there was the idea that was driving the European project forward was that it was a worthwhile engagement because it was going to end war in Europe forever. And yet, when it came down to the pinch, when there was a large question about who pays for what, who's responsible for what, and what are we going to do in the event of a crisis, then what happened was that the national interests took precedence over European cohesion. And I firmly believe that that is why we are now having this rise of populism. What happened during the aftermath of the credit crisis in the US was the sovereign debt crisis in Europe just 18 months later. And that was predicated on a large number of loans that had been made by creditor countries to debtor countries, but that is a mischaracterization of what had actually gone on. Unfortunately, what we have had since is that people have been talking about it was one country lending to another country, but that's not at all what happened. In fact, it was private institutions and savers in creditor nations were investing and in the periphery. And when we say investing, they were lending their money to stoke growth and hoping to gain capital appreciation and a higher yield by investing along the periphery. And that worked wonderfully well for a decade, but then there was the prospect that there was the very real fact that there were housing bubbles in Spain, in Ireland, in Portugal, that Italy had never gone through the reform process to get its house in order, and Greece should never have been allowed into the Eurozone in the first place. So then when those loans started going south, there was the very real prospect that it was going to create a financial crisis in those saver nations. And rather than sit down with the people who had borrowed the money and the people who had lent the money and said, okay, both of us have made mistakes, what we're going to do is we're going to come to an amicable arrangement and everyone is going to share the burden of what has happened equally, that is not at all what happened. There was a very clear push to socialize those private sector debts. Sovereign nations were expected to take full responsibility for their financial sectors, and debt-to-GDP ratios exploded. We have had a 10-year process of fiscal austerity, which has been imposed on just about all countries, but most particularly it has been a burden for those countries that have had to absorb those large debts from their private sectors. And because they have not been able to write off the large number of loans, it represents a continued weight on their respective economies. One of the reasons that the Irish economy has been able to do better and is among the best performing of all markets right now in terms of its GDP is because it's relatively small. It's got a very large exporting sector relative to the size of the population, and it has a very attractive corporate tax rate. So it benefited enormously from the return to growth that the US had. But and then on top of that, it nationalized just about the entire banking sector and created a bad bank and then started to recapitalize. So it took very swift steps in the early stages of the crisis to get out of it, or at least to lay the foundation for a recovery. And we can see very similar steps were taken in a number of the Baltic states, and they have also been able to come out of the crisis in much better form. But that was not the case for France. It was not the case for Italy. We could argue that Greece was just too far gone, that they really should never have been in the euro in the first place. And we can see that, you know, that we have a hybrid situation in Spain, where they have rationalized the banking sector. They did it slower than Ireland did, so their recovery has been slower. There is certainly an advantage, a first mover advantage, an advantage to getting these things done early in the cycle, because the costs just multiply the longer the deflation continues. But it is all the root of this entire discussion is on that very clear decision back in 2010 that it was that we were not going to have European cohesion, that they were going to have European cohesion in name but not in action. Now, what has subsequently happened is that the Europeans have understood what a mistake that was, and they are going to put through a European equivalent of the USA's Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, but it won't really be put in place until the 2020s. And in the meantime, they have imposed on countries like Italy, where this has been a very relevant topic, they have imposed this requirement that any new debt that is used to that is issued by the Italian government will have to have these clauses within it that will ensure, and perhaps we should spell that word, it is not just ensure but insure the EU, that they will get paid back even in the event that that Italy leaves the EU. And because of the amount of debt that Italy has and the duration that is on that debt, they have already passed the point of no return in terms of the easy part. In other words, it would have been much more beneficial for Italy to leave the EU a couple of years ago than it is right now. That doesn't mean that it would ever be an easy process. I don't think anybody considers that it is going to be an easy process to leave the EU. But what we can conclude is that there is one important variable here. People are really ticked off. That is something that we have seen in the UK, we have seen in the USA. And yeah, I think it does behoove us to remember that the French never got to vote on the Nice Treaty. They never got to vote on the European Constitution, and they never got to vote on the Maastricht Treaty. And part of the reason they never got to vote is because French politicians didn't think they'd say yes. And this election that is coming up in April is being framed as a referendum. So this week we did see some some headlines saying that Macron is perhaps advancing in the polls. And there were some questions about how Marine Le Pen is spending her EU money. So this is still only the end of February, and this election won't be until the end of April, and 2 months is a very long time in politics. What we can conclude, though, is that because we still have the fiscal straitjacket, because we still have this policy whereby the creditor nations must be paid back regardless of how silly it was for them to issue these debts in the first place, that and then that it is being placed upon ordinary citizens rather to pay the pensions of people in creditor nations. There is an inherent injustice about all of that, and that is a question. That is something that we just simply cannot anticipate, just take for granted that people are going to continue to accept. So if it isn't France that votes for a reactionary party, then it could be the Netherlands. And there is absolutely no guarantee that Angela Merkel is going to be the next Chancellor of Germany. And that's only this year. There's going to be more elections next year. And that is also assuming that there won't be snap elections called. And Italy certainly represents one of those. When we look at some of the government bonds, then we get a somewhat better picture. What we can also conclude is that the ECB is very active. The one thing that we can absolutely rely on bureaucrats to do is to ensure that they still have jobs. So French government bonds were rallying this week. They are now back below the 1% level, and it is breaking down from this short-term range. Rather than to conclude that this is a medium-term peak, rather it would be perhaps a better question to ask to what extent these yields are going to encounter or are going to find support in the region of the trend mean. There are a great many questions with regard to France, and the most important thing on this chart is that the yield is trading well above the 200-day moving average, so there is a potential for some unwinding of that oversold condition on the price, but that it is trading well above the 200-day moving average, and the moving average has turned upwards, and it would now be required a clear move below it to signal that this is anything other than some short-term steadying. And it is also worth looking at the 2 year in Germany, because, and I'm not typing these very well, the German 2 year is in negative territory, and it's almost at negative 1% yield. So we can see that there is some pressure coming off of the French 10 year, but there is clear evidence of safe haven buying by investors in German bonds. And of course, Germany is now being paid 94 basis points for issuing bonds. It has, and whenever this turns around, it's going to represent quite a change for Germany, because they are being paid to borrow money. And that is a rather ridiculous scenario, but it also goes to show that despite the fact that we have a great deal of debate going on about just what the possibility is of one country or another leaving the EU or leaving the euro, what we can clearly see in German 2 year bonds is that investors are voting with their feet, and they are putting on hedges in no uncertain terms. And they are focusing on the 2 year because a 2 year window is a very handy window in terms of what the timetabling is. We know when the elections are, and we know when The German election is most particularly, that's almost 8 months from now. And we also know what's going to happen after that, because what comes up directly after the German election is the write-down of Greek debt. And that has been promised. And it was very clearly made promised to the Greeks that if they abided by all of the different requirements that were imposed upon them, that write-down of debt would be brought back on the table after the German election. And that will tell you that just how much of a burden the election cycle is on the EU. And because we have so many countries, then the election cycle is always going to be a problem in terms of negotiating anything within the EU. The euro has been pretty variable this week. It's currently trading around 105. The most important thing on that chart is that it has encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean, and it is now in the region of the lows for the range that has been developing for 2 years. There is nothing on the chart to really suggest that this is going to move higher. And we can see that even today it tried to rally, it spent a brief time above 106 and was not able to sustain it. When we look at the dollar index, most people will be thinking, well, golly, the dollar index is rather firm. So then when we look at the when we look at that dollar index, what are we presented with? We're presented with a breakout, and we're presented with the index finding support in the region of the upper side of that range. Part of the reason for that is because the yen has unwound most of its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. It is now trading right in the region of the trend mean, and this is an important area. It strengthened today back to test the low, but what happens next week is going to be very telling indeed. The pound was also weak today, and it remains within this range. It's been a very orderly downtrend, and we cannot conclude that that downtrend has ended until we see a clear break of the progression of lower rally highs. So that is something that we can very clearly see that consistent trends are by far the easiest to analyze from a behavioral technical analysis perspective. Now, when we then look at gold, then we can see that it is now pulling away from the region of the 200-day moving average. It has been rallying pretty persistently for the balance of the year so far, but this is important, and it is a clear breakout from a short-term range, and now trading back above $1,250. So this has been an orderly advance since the beginning of the year. There have been two reactions, and they were relatively modest in size, and now we're resolving once more on the upside. So the 3 month advance is still intact, it's still quite consistent, and we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. That 3 month advance must be viewed in the context of the decline from the July high, and it represents the unwinding of an exaggerated decline which was accelerated in nature following the Donald Trump's success in the presidential election in the US. We won't have clear evidence that demand is back in the driving seat until we're seeing prices sustaining a move above $1,300. So there is still potential for the oversold condition relative to that downtrend, and we can see that the $1,300 area was where there was a big decision made by a lot of investors and a very big tail on the candle. And it represents this psychological level. So then whether we can see prices trading back above $1,300 will be a big psychological event for investors generally. But with prices currently at $1,257, then there's at least another $43 potential upside here. And $1,300 also represents that progression of lower rally highs that has been there since July. But that downtrend from July has to be looked at in the context of what had previously been a 5-year downtrend. And we had this massive reaction against the prevailing downtrend in early 2016. And that was a very big event in terms of that decline from the 2011 lows. So this entire range from the beginning of last year until now could be considered to be a first step above the type 2 bottom. It could be a type 2 bottom with right-hand extension. What we do not know is how long it will range for. There is certainly an upward bias at present. If prices can sustain a move back, can sustain this move above the 200 AMA, improve upon it, and then find support in the region of the EMA on the next pullback, well, that would be really a positive development. That would give people much more confidence that this is more than a short-term rally in gold. What is interesting is that high beta plays on gold, like platinum, and like silver, and like gold shares, have already broken back above their MAs. Platinum has broken successfully back above the $1,000 area and is improving upon that performance this week. Silver has also pulled away from its 200-day moving average and is offering upside. It's a high beta play on gold, so we're getting leverage on gold. And for the first time in a decade, the gold shares are offering leverage to the gold price. So they are now back above their moving average, and provided they can continue to hold that move above the MA, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And gold has got two very important points regarding it right now, is that it is not overly expensive. There are a good many other asset classes are trading at pretty rich valuations, and yet gold prices and the gold shares relative to the gold price are trading at pretty close to historic lows. Even after the big advance that we had last year, a good deal of that has already been unwound. So that is certainly a point in its favor. But the additional point, of course, is that it cannot simply be printed into existence. And when we have one of the biggest currencies in the world with such very large question marks standing over it, then there is a clear argument for why someone should be thinking about gold. And India, being an historic buyer of gold, I think the rupee is something that we should really watch at this stage. And if we look at it the other way around, and I may have to take a second attempt at this, but yes, definitely INR USD it should be. If we look at it the other way around, then we're presented with a very clear downtrend. And that downtrend has lost momentum. India and the rupee have been, well, it hit an important low in 2013. We're in 2017 now, and the price is still around the same level. But it is now trading back above the 200-day moving average. And despite the fact that it is only modestly so, it is trading back above the moving average. And what that also helps to really confirm for us is that rather than it being a strong dollar story, it is much more of a weak euro story and a weak yen story. So what happens with the yen in the next week or two is really going to be important. But India has got a number of, I think, important aspects going for it right now. One is that inflation is beginning to come back down. So that is really very positive. That should lend some additional strength to the rupee. The Bombay Banks Index moved to a new all-time high this week, and it has been a reliable lead indicator for the market for a prolonged period. And the fact that it is moving to a new high is very positive indeed. And Reliance Industries, which is the largest share in the index and representative of the growth potential for that market, broke upwards this week. Now, there are a number of developments with regard to Reliance. One is that it has held this progression of higher reaction lows since 2012. And in the last few years, it has spent a great deal of money on capital expenditure, and that is now over. So having sown the seeds, it may be moving into a period of time where it can reap some of the rewards. One of the things that was released just in the last year, excuse me, in the last month or two, was that Reliance had built a 4G network for India. And until the end of last year, the majority, the vast majority of people with a mobile phone in India had 2G connectivity. And now for a very modest price, they can have 4G connectivity. And that's a great example of how technological innovation is, as it is rolled out, is of particular benefit to emerging economies, because they get to skip whole rungs in terms of the ladder of technological development. They can go from the equivalent of fixed line to 4G overnight. That's likely to be an incredibly powerful enabler for economic development within India, considering that such a large proportion of the population is unbanked, that the rollout of mobile banking, and they have already been experimenting with ATMs that can be used without for people who are illiterate, because not only does India have a large number of cultures, a large number of languages, but that there is a very large number of people who are illiterate. So there is certainly a challenge in advancing the role of technology within the economy when you have so many people that are illiterate, and yet the user interfaces on mobile devices are so incredibly simple that we can see children picking them up, and within a couple of weeks they are usually more adept at using the mobile device than their parents. And that also is a very positive development, so that we could have a large number of people that could become banked within the Indian economy, and that would be an incredibly positive development. And it does suggest that the lengthy ranging phase, the period of underperformance in the currency, might be coming to an end. There are a large number of open questions about just what is going on in China. And part of the reason that we have had such a decline in confidence in the ability of the Chinese administration to manage the economy is because they keep messing up financial innovations, that they introduced the options market and didn't do a particularly good job of doing that, and then they caused a bubble. When some of the options started getting called in, then the market peaked and then collapsed. They had to intervene very aggressively, and the market was largely on life support for a year. In the government bond markets, they introduced government bond futures and created something of a short-term bubble, and now that has popped, so government bond yields have gone back up. They introduced and because they have been trying to contain the speed with which the renminbi has been going down, that initiated a bubble in Bitcoin, and Bitcoin had a substantial pullback. But despite all of these uncertainties, the H-share index in Hong Kong has cleared the 10,000 level, and it is not expensive. It is trading on a single-digit multiple, and it yields 3.5%. So there is certainly the potential for that to advance. I thought I would put up the Bitcoin chart because despite the fact that it had pulled back, it was moving to a new high in here today, but was not able to hold that move up to $1,200, suggesting that there are still plenty of Chinese investors willing to put their money into the cryptocurrency as a way to either hedge their exposure to the renminbi or to try and get their money out of the country and to skirt capital controls. The renminbi has is gradually unwinding its oversold condition relative to the trend mean, but this has been a very orderly decline, and there isn't any great evidence that it is over. The Chinese need a weaker currency, and I suspect that there must be some line in the sand in terms of the declining reserves that they have. They've gone from over something like 3.5 trillion to less than 3 trillion, and that has left the country, and that they have spent in an attempt to slow the decline of the currency. At some point, since there is no sign that dissipation of reserves has ended, at some point they're going to have to make a decision about how much of the reserves are they willing to spend. And at that point you get a devaluation. And that is the risk for investors in mainland China. And that is also, of course, why foreign investors are so active in the offshore renminbi market. So, and it is obviously the because that is where foreign investors are so active, that is where the People's Bank of China tends to concentrate its efforts to support the currency. But the renminbi has already unwound its oversold condition there, and there is clear evidence of selling pressure around 6.8, which is approximating the region of the trend mean right now. And I guess I've spent the balance of this audio talking about the risks, and perhaps we should talk about the opportunities. The Nasdaq is representing a clear relative strength. It is very heavily weighted by the big disruptors in this market right now. It is led by these technology companies, and the most important thing that has happened is that it is at a new all-time high. That we had a pretty lengthy consolidation in the region of the previous peak, and now it has been resolved on the upside. Even on that daily chart, we can see that it has rallied for 33 of the last 34 sessions. So this has been a powerful breakout, and there is no evidence just yet that it has ended. There is the potential that we get a reversionary move, and that prices come back down to test the region of the trend mean. But by and large, this is a demand-dominated environment. So technology is certainly a big theme in this market, in particular in the Nasdaq, but the return to outperformance of the banking sector, and most particularly the domestic banking sector in the US, is also a very big deal. This is another index that is trading at an all-time high. And obviously it has gone up very quickly. It is at risk that the fiscal stimulus, the economic reform, the regulatory reform or deregulation and higher interest rates that this advance has been predicated on are not delivered. That is the risk. But in the meantime, I think the market is probably willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. Of course, we do know that Donald Trump will be making a very important speech next week, and that could be a potential catalyst for some pause and consolidation in what has been a very powerful breakout so far on Wall Street. But a clear downward dynamic would really be required to even check the advance as it continues to push higher. When we look at this over the long term, we went through a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and that was replaced by synchronized monetary expansion, And there is the possibility that we move into a period of synchronized fiscal expansion. The US is certainly moving that way. Japan is already there, so is China. The big question is what is going to happen in Europe. If the Europeans really do want to allay the possibility of a clear reactionary movement growing further, then abandoning the fiscal straitjacket and going for stimulus would be a clear answer to that question. Not necessarily the best answer, but it is an answer, and it would likely at least begin to assuage fears on the periphery that they have no say in how their countries are being run. When we really do think about the long term, if we do get fiscal expansion against a background where economic growth is improving, then that is the epitome of a pro-cyclical environment. It would suggest that we could have a very big bull market. Now, that would be on top of a bull market that has already been in existence for over 8 years. So then we would have to conclude that there is the potential that after we have the fiscal stimulus, then some of those debts would have to be paid back. And what would happen then? And what happens with the bond markets, and most particularly 10-year treasuries, is going to be a big deal, because bond yields today were did pull did bond prices advance, so yields pulled back, and suggesting that we are getting this reversion to the mean. It has been a risk. It's always a risk when you see something that goes up a lot quickly, loses momentum, and then the reversion to the mean can happen quickly. We might be seeing that now. And that is very much in tune with the buy the dips strategy that has worked every time in the last 36 years. The real proof that the bond bull market is over would be when the buy the dip strategy fails. So we are likely to see yields come back to the trend mean, but that 2% level will have to hold in order to confirm a low of or a higher reaction low in terms of the yield, but a resistance coming in below the peak in terms of the price. The Merrill Lynch Total Return Index for 10-year Treasury futures, which is the epitome of the buy the dip strategy, has clearly broken downwards. It has pushed back up towards the moving average, but in order to confirm that this is a completed top formation, it will have to encounter resistance in the region of the trend mean. And that would be a pivotal development. That would be something that we would have to really start to consider, that we are in an inflationary environment, which is probably being supplemented by fiscal stimulus on top of economic growth. And that would represent higher interest rates overall. That might represent a challenge for the US, but it would represent a very big challenge for Europe, which has been heavily reliant on the lower interest rates that the ECB has been charging. So there is certainly a lot to look at, and we can simply assess the price action as we see it. And certainly it is Wall Street is leading, and the Wall Street leash effect is supplementing the outlook for emerging markets, but most particularly US allies in Asia. That the topics in the, the excuse me, I will look at the topics, but the TAIEX index in Taiwan is coming back up towards that 10,000 level. The Bombay Banks Index has already broken out, and the Nifty is testing its highs. When we look at the Korean market, then it has been range bound for 6 years, following that big pullback in 2011, and it is now pushing back up towards the upper side of that range. So there is certainly evidence of the Wall Street leash effect. The TOPIX index has been ranging since 1990, That really does feel like a long time ago. That 1750 area represents the upper side of a very long range. If we were to see it breaking out, it would suggest that the disinflationary environment that has really acted as a headwind for Japan is over, and that could represent a very bullish factor for Japan over the medium to longer term, considering just how long it has been in this deflationary spiral form. So there are certainly risks, but there are also clear opportunities, and we will continue to monitor them. And with that, I will leave you for today, and I wish all the best to all of you.